that ring a bell somewhere? Okay, possibly. I know it's very early in the morning, and we're still going through it. Do you want it over there, too? Is that better, to have it on both projectors? Yes, possibly. Okay, let's figure out how we do that. Oh, crap. Okay. Projector 1. Projector 2. Probably turn the whole thing off if I'm not careful. There you go. Okay, so we're still wrapping up with circulatory, right? We got to this point about I think we left off talking about calcium entry, right? And potentials. We kind of went through that scheme that we drew on the overhead in class about what did we go through for like the act for calcium entry for contraction. Do you remember that scheme at all? What happened? There's a little bit of calcium leak from the ER, right? Did y'all make notes yet? Blank piece of paper, the best thing to study. Talk to yourself, it won't lock you up, I promise. So think about what happened. There's a little leak of calcium, right? You got the cell. And if you can image these things, then I think it'll help you. Calcium's leaking out of the ER a little bit, right? Then what happens? That calcium leaks out. What happens to that calcium? It has to be taken out of the cell. So what's taking it out? Sodium-calcium exchanger, right? Sodium's coming in. But that, generally, this is one of the ideas, is that causes a depolarization of the cell, right? So if that depolarizes the cell, then more sodium's going to come in. That depolarizes a bit more, and there's another threshold for calcium channels. So then calcium channels start to open. Calcium comes into the cell. What does that little bit of calcium do inside the cell? It does what to an internal organelle in the cell? Calcium-induced calcium release, called CIRCA. Sometimes that's on standardized exams, because it's a cardiac one, CIRCA. Calcium-induced calcium release. So the calcium comes in that actually causes calcium to be released from the internal store. The ranitidine receptor actually is sensitive to calcium. So that little bit of calcium causes more calcium to be released. So that raises calcium up even more. Now, at the same time, that's really raising it up, but then what's going to happen? Well, you've got the calcium pump, and you've still got the exchanger and stuff like that. But when calcium gets really high, that's a negative feedback back on the ranitidine receptor, and it inhibits the ranitidine receptor from allowing calcium out. So now the calcium can still be pumped out, and it's not even leaking anymore, so the calcium drops down. Then when the calcium really drops down, what's going to happen? The ranitidine receptor no longer has a negative inhibition, and the whole cycle starts over again. Kind of get the idea? It's really neat, but that's one of the ideas that how this whole process works. And it's still debated a bit today. So you would think, all this should be down pat, you know, cardiac is so important. But this is how complicated it is in the sense of all these different ion channels. You can explore it if you want, whatever you want to do. Whatever works. You just got to be aggressive to get in there. So that was part of that. But I don't want you to be confused with this potential. This is where it gets confusing from years to years. And every textbook sometimes confuses people because you're just kind of in that mode of study. What is this potential of right here? And this is what's appeared on standardized exams quite a bit too. And you notice that long potential, that long plateau. And remember we talked about how long this is. This is an action potential in your ventricular muscle, right? In your ventricular cardiac muscle, which is going to do what? Pump blood out of the ventricle, right? Contract, long-term contraction. How do you have that long-term contraction? By depolarizing the cell for a long time and have a lot of calcium inside the cell, so you can have a lot of calcium binding to what? Troponin I, T, or C? Calcium for... Rah, rah, rah. He's on the cheerleader team. C, right? You know, you remember this stuff? Come on, y'all. You got to need some caffeine injections. So calcium binds to troponin C, causes a conformational change, exposes an active site, That active site's exposed, myosin head binds, boom, you get contraction, right? Okay, so the longer that calcium, that depolarization, you have more calcium coming in. Where does calcium come into the cell in a cardiac cell? This is kind of review for your skeletal muscle stuff too. Extracellular and intracellular, right? So ECF and sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that depolarization in the ventricle is very important for long depolarization to get calcium loading, so you have a strong, long contraction to get the blood out of your ventricle. But look at the shape of this. So why do we have a long plateau? Well, it's because this is not an action potential in a neuron. It's more like the nerve terminal. Remember, the nerve terminal is a bit unique in the sense that you have voltage-gated calcium channels there. But still, that action potential is probably only about a millisecond or two. Nobody won the $100 yet to really get a direct measure in a mammalian neuron, right? So it's by inference from your favorite preparations, which are invertebrates. But generally, it's a little bit longer in the nerve terminals because of voltage-gated calcium channels. Right? This is a review, right? Kind of. Okay. So, but in a cardiac ventricular muscle, 250 milliseconds, really long, right? Okay. So that is standardized. Kind of, you'll see those on Kaplan reviews. You'll see them on standardized exams, DSAT, pharmacy exams, MCAT exams. Why do you have the long plateau and the ventricular muscle? Sometimes that's worded really wrong, actually, on these standardized exams, are actually in the Kaplan book, because they don't tell you, they say cardiac muscle. But it really depends what muscle in the cardiac, what cells in the heart we're talking about. This is a ventricular muscle, not the atrial muscle, not the SA node, not the AV node, not the bundle of His, not the Purkinje fibers, right? So there's lots of different cells in your heart for cardiac function. This is the ventricular muscle in the heart. Okay, so let's go back a little bit to make sure that we're getting this straight. So remember we talked about this. This is something different, right? This is where people get confused. And I'm not trying to confuse you. I'm going to make sure that this is dwelling this into your head. This is the pacemaker potential. Where is this occurring? SA node, right? And then the AV node has a little bit different, but generally like this in the SA node. And it's still not totally worked out. There's people that have their whole careers doing nothing but this work for the last 20, 30, 40 years probably, working on the ion channels that control the pacemaker potential. The point that's it's kind of odd that you might not, you know, initially think about, it's very odd because of the nervous system that we talked about before. When this cell, remember there's no real resting membrane potential in a pacemaker cell. It's always pacing, right? But at the low potential, it actually allows sodium to go in. It actually opens up sodium channels. So in this kind of hyperpolarized, if you will, or more the lowest state, it's actually allowing sodium to come in. So the depolarization, trick question, the depolarization of the pacemaker potential is due to what? The funny channel, the funny sodium channel. Because it's open at rest, right? Usually you're thinking of the voltage-gated sodium channel in the neuron opening after it reaches threshold. These are open at a low potential. And so if you have a negative 60 and you allow sodium to go in, what's happening? The driving gradient is still way up here, needs sodium, right? So sodium's going to go in. It's going to depolarize the cell. So the initial depolarization of the pacemaker potential is due to the sodium flux, due to this funny channel. That's why they call it an F. So, but what's that going to do? That depolarizes the cell. Now think like the neuron. What has a higher threshold? Other voltage-gated channels. And the other voltage-gated channels are calcium channels. And so now calcium flows in. And that really gives rise to the big peak on the cardiac pacemaker potential. But the initial depolarization is due to sodium coming in. Okay? Try to keep that straight. Different from the cardiac action potential in the muscle fibers. This is where it gets confusing. This is where every year people get that mixed in. Okay? And it could be mixed in on standardized exams, so you have to kind of watch that. make sure you know what tissue you're talking about. Okay, so that's the main point. So that slow depolarization, pacemaker potential, they call it, is really due initially to the sodium channel depolarizing and then opening up the calcium channels, and then calcium for that rise, and potassium, of course, has another threshold, open up potassium channels, because if you open up potassium channels here, what's going to happen? E-potassium's here. There's no real net flux, right? It's just going to stay here. But if you go high, now E-potassium's down here, so you got a big driving grade, so now it can bring it back down, right? So that's the idea with the potential. So to try to keep that straightforward. Okay, we went through this generally, that SA node initially, you know, what is it? How many beats per minute about? 70. And if that's not working, then down to the AV node, lower rate, you know, maybe 50. And then if that's not working, bundle of His, right? Maybe 50 to 40 or something. And then if that's not working, the Purkinje fibers will take over about 20 beats per minute. So your heart has a lot of redundancy to try to keep it going. But if they're not in sync, you get all these different kind of arrhythmias. You don't have to memorize all those different arrhythmias. It's so cool, though, to go into that cardiac EKG stuff. It's really neat if you get involved. Okay, so we just went through that, basically. And we went through this. So then we get to that part about, well, you have to depolarize, you know, the electrical event. Now, what's this action potential of again? This red line? Ventricular muscle, right? So now we depolarize the ventricular muscle, calcium loads in, you get the contraction, right? And then you get the contractile response, which is delay bit. And then we're going to go through, like you did in lab, this wonderful lab, on your EKG already, right? So everybody should know the standard EKG. And there's a lot more in your notes on these PowerPoints than really we need to go over, but the general points that you've already written this up, the EKG is phenomenal because you can tell so much about the heart just from a non-invasive measurement. It's amazing what they can tell from in the heart. And not only that, maybe ionic imbalance as well, right? So there's a lot that you can get out of the EKG. And we know that ECG, it's just want to make sure, because there was actually a first year med student that came back one year when I saw him. He said, did you know the EKG and ECG are the same thing? So he didn't take 350. But anyways, ECG, you know, cardio in English, EKG, cardio in German, right? So EKG and ECG, same thing, please. All right, so that's the same. So we should know what these waves mean, and we should know generally what do they refer to. And I know you had this in lab, and sometimes it's a little confusing. The main things to kind of think about is that, let's go look at it first. P is what? What do you want to first do to your heart? Depolarize your atrium, right? Push blood into your ventricles. And then just think about it logically. When blood goes into your ventricles, what do you want to do? Contract your ventricles and get it out. But there's this little funny thing that comes over here. What is this? Anybody remember what that is, the T wave? Ventricular repolarization, right? Why don't we have a atrial repolarization? This is a confusing point sometimes. Some people say, and some textbooks say, it's buried in the QRS complex, but even if you have a block, you don't really see the atrial repolarization anyways, because it's probably so small, so it's sometimes a misconception. But anyways, depends who you talk to. But we'll go through a little bit of this. So what is this relating to? And then what's a segment versus an interval? And I know that's confusing. It's because it's not consistent. But let's look at some of that. So what is a PR? We can go ahead with it right here. So what is a PR interval? And you might get this on standardized exams. It depends. Old Kaplan books have that kind of stuff. But, and hopefully not to torture you too much with it. But PR interval, and I'm not going to break this up in the exam, but there's some parts that we need to know what the concept is, okay? What do they mean? So what is the PR interval? Atrial depolarization to the point of where the ventricle depolarizes. But the PR interval includes the P. So usually the intervals include one of the waveforms. Now, you would think that you could memorize it really nicely, like P, R, so it includes the P to the R. But then you get over here, and you look at the interval, some of these other intervals, like the ST interval, and you think, oh, that means it includes the S to the T. But no, of course not. It's beginning of the S and includes the T. So on that side of the QRS, it's the first wave to the point. On this side of the QRS, it's the first, the end of the whatever that wave is, to include the second part, the T interval. That might help you on standardized exams to kind of remember that too. I know it's a little crazy, right? Because this doesn't include the S, but it's still an interval, but it includes the T. You get the point? Are you okay? It's early in the morning. Okay. But then look at this one. To confuse you more. QT interval has the whole Q in the T. Alright? I know. Alright. But what do these mean as the main things? So what is the P to the Q? Atrial depolarization to the ventricular depolarization. So what does that include? What gives rise to the PR? Why is the PR so important to look at? For your heart. What does it relate to? The depolarization, right, of the atrium, but it's also the time it takes before it gets to the ventricle, right? So what's between those two? What's causing the longest delay here? What's the main point here in this? You're dumping the blood from the atrium to the ventricles, but what's causing that delay? Pardon?
The plateau phase.
No, that ventricle we're going to be talking about in here. This is the atrium, so it's a good point, too. What? Pardon? Not so much the valve. I'm talking about the electrical. I know we're on the right point, but now think about what do we have to do? We SA node, AV node. Does it just go right through the AV node? The AV node is where it slows down, right? So now we're talking about the slowing down before we get to the ventricle. So trick questions have been, oh, it just means from the SA to the ventricle or to the AV node, but it means through the AV node. And the AV node is what slows down the electrical event. So it's really the delay in the AV node that causes most of this delay. So it's kind of interesting to think about. So put that together in there. Now there's some other waves on here, and I don't want you to have to memorize them, but you should at least hear about that there are new waves, because generally we don't hear about them. But and these are kind of interesting. We'll just go through some of it for the general knowledge, but I don't want to test you on all these because it gets too much involved. But I think you might have some interest in there for clinical interest. Okay, so these tables I have up there, you don't have to memorize the values, the numbers, but in general you should know that which ones are kind of longer and which ones, you know, are short. And why do we measure, like, from R wave to R wave? Well, that gives us a heart rate, right? And it's easier to measure from peak to peak. So you might have done that in your EKG. Is that what y'all did in your EKG? So it's just easier to measure. Okay. And the QRS, don't worry about the direction of it so much. It just depends on which way you're recording the leads. So, what's interesting, too, are the heart sounds. So sound 1, sound 2, sound 3, sound 4. And so what are these sounds? Lub-dub, lub-dub, lub-dub. But you can actually hear some of the other sounds. We generally just think about lub-dub, but there are other sounds that people can hear, especially like in infants. So what does lub refer to? Lub-dub. So your heart... Mostly the atrium, you don't, this is kind of atrial stuff over here, we'll talk about. But the atrial, blood's coming in, right, just kind of passive, coming in. And then the atria contract, push blood into the ventricle. Now these are the big, you know, workhorses, right? So when the ventricles contract, what do? They push back, close the AV valves, right? Boom, lub, right, lub. And then what happens? It's building up pressure. Finally exceeds the pressure in the pulmonary artery, exceeds the pressure in the aorta, pushes blood into the pulmonary, pushes blood into the aorta, you know, going through, and then the ventricles relax. Then what happens to blood? Backflow. Boom. Snap those valves closed. Dub. So, lub, dub. right? Love is closing the first valves, the AV valves. Dove is closing the semilunar valve, of the aortic valve, and the pulmonary artery valve. So that's love dove. These other sounds that you might have hear about or have heard about, like S3 and S4. S4 is, and these are thought to be due to some of the atrial filling, and it's interesting in that sense, but I'm not going to test you on like S3 and S4. But just that you know that there's these other sounds, just like you know that there's a U wave, that's interesting too. Okay, so we should know these love dubs, and that's the main ones, right? The most common ones. S3 and S4 are kind of interesting. Now, on your PowerPoints that you might have downloaded from the web, on the web page, these kind of got pushed off the slide, so you can make the slide smaller and see them. I don't want you to have to put too much emphasis on S3 and S4, but Kentucky's known for something. It's actually in the sounds of the heart. They actually use this in standard textbooks. Kentucky, the way you break it up, Kentucky. If you hear that when you're listening to someone's heart, then you know you're getting the sound 3. And if you hear Tennessee, the fourth sound, then you know it's this other point. And these have to do with some interesting aspects on the heart. So it's sometimes rare to hear this fourth sound, but people listen to it. If you ever listen to your own heart, other things to do with your significant other, you know, you can listen to their hearts. Right, so it's kind of interesting to hear about. Lots of people have murmurs, a bit of a murmur. What's a murmur? Anybody know what a murmur is? What's a murmur? If you heard a murmur,
the arrhythmic,
not an arrhythmic heartbeat, but maybe a valve not working right, right? Like, lub dub, lub dub, lub dub. You know, love dub, right? Something like that. What if you had a love dub, a love swish dub? Love swish dub. What would that be? Love is closing, trying to close these valves, but maybe they don't close all the way, right? Maybe there's some insufficient, maybe the valve is inverted back into the atrium, so shh, right? So it could be something like that. Love dubs might be what? What's love? Close these valves. What's dub? Closing these valves, but maybe they didn't close well, right? So you're getting the swishing sound. So you can understand where the problem is by listening to sounds. That's why it's so interesting to listen to these sounds. Okay, so this is the kind of, that helps put it in perspective, and that's why the ventricular, now you see the ventricular action potential has that long plateau, right? And that's why that's there in the ventricle compared to the SA node or the atrium, kind of looks like the ventricular potential, because what? You have to contract the atria for a given amount of time too, right? Push blood into the ventricle, so you want a little bit longer on the atrial muscle, right? On the muscle right here, right? And that's a little longer just to try to get the atrium to contract, and then you go through the AV node, which is the delay in that PR segment, right, or PR interval, and then you get down the bundle of His and the ventricular muscle and contract. Okay, EKGs, the first ones, if you look at, like on Wikipedia page, there was a dog where they first did this, and they put him in, you know, water, like salt water, and had him standing there, and this all came from Germany a long time ago. Really quite neat to relate to all this action, different responses. And they record EKGs in all kinds of animals, fish, for example, too. And you can get ideas of the heart rates. So it's really quite interesting. Okay, but, you know, that's the main point. Everybody knows what systole and diastole is. I hope systole, the contraction phase, diastole, the relaxation phase, and the filling of the heart. So if you're beating faster, what happens? The filling phase decreases, right? Diastole decreases, and you're not going to get as much blood in the ventricles. And remember, left and right are the same, right? You can't have blood building up on the right side. It has to get through the system. So they're happening at the same time on both sides, but pressures. And so I think the easiest way to look at some of these, these are more or less for you to look through, but the point that you have to get to is this figure here. And this figure is really important to take a blank piece of paper sometime and really just ride it out, because there's so much to this. And I know it might be a little hard to see in the back, but you can slide up. But let's go through this, you know, and you really have to start off with the EKG. So you should draw the EKG trace and then draw what's happening. And what they have here is the side of the heart. What side of the heart is this? Is this the left ventricle or the right ventricle? When you see this, right? It says left, right? Left. So these pressures are much higher than what you're going to get on the right side. So some textbooks will show you the pressure wave for the right side or the left side. So depending on what text or what you're looking at, make sure you know what kind of side you're looking at. So the left side's usually used because it has the higher pressure side, and it's a little bit easier to understand. But you can do the same thing for the right side, but the pressures are lower, okay? The main point. So here we have the P's. What's that going to do? That's atrial depolarization. So what do we expect to happen in the atrium? Well, we expect then the pressure to build up in the atrium. And that's this, let's see if I can't get it to project on that thing. That's this little green line right there, right? So that pressure is building up. And then what's happening? Is that right? Yes. And then what's happening? Well, left ventricular volume. It's beginning to go up because it's slowly filling in, right? And then when the atrium contracts, what happens? Pushes blood into the ventricle, right? So you expect the volume to go way up. And now when the atrium's finished contracting and pushing blood in the ventricle, and the ventricle contracts to close the valve, is the ventricle filling up with more blood? No. It stopped, right? Because now you pushed everything into it and the valve's closed. So this is what's referred to, that isometric volume contraction is this point. Iso means the same, right? The same. The volume is not changing, right? But what's happened to the pressure in the ventricle? These are standardized exam type of questions if you're interested in any of those health exams later on in for this class. The iso volumetric contraction. So the volume's not changing right here, but what's happening to the pressure wave? The ventricular pressure wave is shooting way up, right? Because the ventricle's contracting, the valves are closed on both, the atrium to the ventricle, in the pulmonary, in the aortic valves. But let's just look at the left side. The aortic valve's still closed, but the pressure's building up. So this is isovolumetric, but the pressure is increasing. And then what's happening right here. So you got to know what these points are. If you looked at old standardized exams, there's lots of different questions over the years about drawing a circle here. What's happening here? 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 Right? So you've not got to go through this and really know it. So what's happening right here? Anybody? Ventricular muscles contracting, pushing blood. This is the left side. What happened right here? Blood is going where? Next. What's the big vessel that goes out of your left heart, left side of the ventricle? The aorta, right? So the aortic valve just opened, and now we're pushing blood into the aorta. Now, can you push blood from a low pressure into a high pressure system? Pay attention to the words. Low pressure to high pressure. Can you get low pressure into high pressure? No, right? So what has to happen during this time? The pressure in the ventricle has to be higher than the aortic pressure, right? So to get blood to move into the aorta, the ventricular pressure is higher than the aorta. And then when the ventricle starts to relax and the pressure drops below the aorta, that's when the valve's going to close. Boom, right? Because now the ventricle's relaxing. And then this little notch, in some texts they show it, in some they don't. This little notch is called the dicrotic notch. And it's because if you had a pressure measuring, if you were able to feed it on through to the aorta and right next to the valve, you would see this little blip. And this little blip is blood going to the aorta, and then when the ventricle relaxes, it comes back and closes the valve. And it's this little recoil of closing the valve, so you get this dicrotic notch. Okay, so that's this thing. But what else is happening when you go into the aorta? The aorta is this, and this is part of the next part of this chapter. is an elastic, like an elastic balloon, right? So it's going to distend. It has what's called distensibility or elasticity, right? So sometimes people ask these questions on exam. What does distensibility mean? It's elasticity. And you get the hint. If it's on an exam in the past, it might be an exam in the future, right? So distensibility. So it can extend out and take that pressure. And so it distends out, and then when the ventricle relaxes, the blood comes back and closes the valve, right? And then what does that distensibility do for the body? It helps to maintain the pressure wave to then feed the systemic circulation. Okay, so that's what's happening in here. And so now the ventricle relaxes, and then relaxes back down. What happens to the aortic pressure in the aorta? Well, it's down again until the next cycle, because now it's feeding on through the body, right? Systemic circulation. And then the whole thing repeats. And the atria, you know, builds up here because of the contraction, and then it has this little bleep again because the ventricles are contracting and pushing against the atrium, and then it relaxes when the ventricle's relaxing after it starts to relax, and then it built. Oh, here's a better figure. Sorry, I should have been doing this one to begin with. And then you can see what's happening here, and then relaxation. Now, all these little numbers, you get the idea? We should kind of know what's happening with these little numbers in ventricular volume. Trick questions, or I wouldn't say trick, but kind of like confuse people, are these times called isometric contraction or isometric filling, because the atrium haven't opened yet, but the ventricle's relaxed, and so you don't see any change in the volume here, but the volume drops as blood's going from the ventricle into the aorta, but then it doesn't change until the valve opens from the AV valve, right? And then you get this passive filling, and then again contraction in the atrium, and then you'll get that burst of filling, and then it goes back through the whole cycle. Okay, so the sounds, look at the sounds, you know. Lub, dub, lub, dub. What does this refer to again? You know? AV valves closing, aortic and pulmonary artery valves, so the two together, right? So you're talking about both valves together all the time. Okay, so any questions generally about that? Mass confusion? Okay, all right, I know. Everybody's quiet. So some little things to remember, and remember, there is no way, I have to make the test still, but there's no way to have everything on the exam, otherwise it would be another three-hour exam of just multiple choices, right? And you don't want that. So, you know, can't put everything on, but in what we don't have this time, we might see on the final, right? Because the final's comprehensive. So I don't know what we'll put on there yet, because we have to still make the thing. But cardiac output, we should know, is heart rate times stroke volume. That's just standard. You might even get that on standardized exams. So if the heart rate goes up, cardiac output goes up. The output is the volume per time, right? And stroke volume is how much the heart can pump out each time. And so, you know, it's part of it. And cardiac output is affected by multiple things, right? If your sickness or age, all those changes, our activity, if you exercise, what happens to your heart rate? It goes up. So will cardiac output. But the stroke volume might change as well, and it depends on how fast you go. If it's ventricular arrhythmia or ventricular fibrillation, like it's going too fast, right? How much is stroke volume going to be? Practically nothing, right? Because it can't fill. So you might have a high heart rate, but stroke volume isn't being able to fill, so cardiac output actually drops if it goes too fast. So there is a trade-off there if it goes too quick, and that's why this is important to kind of measure. Okay, we've talked about heart regulation before, right? Vagal and parasympathetic with vagal nerve, the 10th cranial nerve, and sympathetic can go directly on the heart muscle. And the vagal nerve, what does it do? Generally slows down the heart, right? Slows down the SA node, and the sympathetic generally can reduce, this is kind of neat, it can reduce the AV node. So if you wanted a trick question, would the PR interval be longer or shorter with sympathetic stimulation? If it reduces the AV node delay, then it should be shorter, right? So, you know, those kind of ideas, those kind of questions. And you could see that in your EKG trace. So think about pulling it together, not just trying to memorize, but try to think about it all together. But it can also increase what we call the inotropic ability of the ventricle. So the two words to kind of remember, you might hear those sometime on other type of standardized execs too, chronotropic and inotropic. Chrone for time, that means rate, and inotropic, the strength of contraction. So chronotropic and inotropic. So it can increase both, sympathetic, chronotropic, time, and inotropic, the strength of contraction. Okay, so some generalized figures to kind of get the idea of that, and rate changing, speeding up, or slowing down, one way or the other, and we've talked about that kind of aspect. So some controls of the heart are really interesting. Remember we talked about in endocrine, a little bit of a review, endocrine, what happens when the atria fill up with too much blood? What's released from the atrium? What hormone? If you're stretching the atria?
We've purged all the endocrine stuff.
Don't do that yet. What's the hormone released from the atrium if you stretch the atrial tissue? Anybody remember?
AMP.
Atrial natriuretic peptide, right? And what does that do? That says, hey, we need to get rid of that volume. So it works to increase diuresis, so you decrease your blood volume, right? And but that's kind of interesting. The atria will be able to do that in longer-term conditions. But in short-term conditions, there's something very interesting with your ventricles. And it happens throughout all the mammals that people have really studied. And this is called the Frank-Starling principle. So the more filling in your ventricle, the more stretching of the ventricle, it can actually contract harder the next time. So if you push more blood into the ventricle and stretch it, it's like a big rubber band. It's going to actually have a better contraction the next time. So it's called the Frank-Starling principle. And why this is, people think about, it's to protect the heart from overfilling and then damaging the muscles. So if it can get that blood out and get it circulating, it's pretty neat. But so you might see that sometime. So it's an increase in stretching of the ventricle. The ventricle actually has a better ability to contract and stronger contraction to get that blood out. So the next time, it won't have that stretching. So Frank-Starling principle. And we talked about extrinsic. So that's like an intrinsic control. An extrinsic control, we talked about sympathetic system, you know, increasing the contractility, right? And sympathetic stimulation also does what? Out to the periphery to increase blood coming in. Well, it can contract veins and enhance the venous return. Remember, most of your blood in your body is really stored in your veins. If you're just sitting here like this, there's probably a lot of blood pooling in your veins right now. You can mobilize it by sympathetic, get excited, like we're going to get a pop quiz today. That'll get you going. And then, or if you started, you know, moving your legs, the muscle contraction also helps to move that around. So these kind of diagrams are pretty neat to kind of get an idea of. And understanding the regulation of heart rate and this end-diastolic volume, like we just talked about, increases the stroke volume, right? Because you can get more blood in, then you can contract it better and get more out too, so cardiac output.
So the whole idea, just kind of look over the idea. What's really interesting is this local regulation too of the heart, which is pretty neat. We've talked about coronary arteries, which are, you know, the blood vessels that feed your heart. You hear somebody with a heart attack, it's usually a blocked blood vessel, right, on their coronary circulation of their heart. But then some other aspects that are pretty neat. If you get a decrease in blood flow to the heart, and what can actually happen is that hypoxia will stimulate adenosine release, and that can actually cause vasodilation. So this is pretty neat. Adenosine is formed from ATP. But when oxygen supply is low, like hypoxia, that will actually cause adenosine to be released, and that causes vasodilation. It's kind of like a, hey, I need some help here, and getting more blood flow. So it's a pretty neat aspect to think about what can happen. But still, you know, what's number one cause of death in the U.S. is, and worldwide actually, is heart failure, right? And cardiac issues, number one reason worldwide. Okay, so we're here. So I know this is a, you know, a little bit maybe much on those figures, but the take home is very straightforward.
if you have a small blood vessel, how much blood can go through that compared to a big blood vessel, right? So it's back to the garden hose and fire hose analogy. Do you remember those? Back when we talked about it for action potentials, electrical activity. And the equation, you're thinking, oh God, another math equation. It's the same one you should have your tattoo already. Like Ohm's law, I equals V over R. It's the same idea. What was I? I was current. V was voltage, right? And R was resistance. So it's the same as the electrical ones that we talked about. I equals V over R. Well, I, flow, or current, and then you get V, which is the pressure difference, and R. So it's really the same idea as Ohm's law that we talked about. So how do we control flow or current? Well, the gradient, either the electrical gradient or the pressure gradient in the heart. And then resistance is going to have a factor. So if we have a small tube versus a garden, you know, fire hose, there's differences in resistance. If you start to have atherosclerosis and you build up plaque, you've got more resistance, right? So that's pretty neat. So the pressure difference, the point they're making here, is the pressure difference is the same here, 80 and 80, but the overall pressures, the absolute pressures, are higher in this example, but there's no difference in the flow because the pressure difference is the same and the resistance is the same, but you're at higher levels. So this is part of the problem with higher blood pressure, right? You might be working at a higher blood pressure. The flow is really no different, but you're really putting a lot more stress on the blood vessels themselves. What's the big difference is that if you have a change in the... What happened to my thing? I thought I had another one here. Oh yeah, here, this main point. So the main point is here, if you've increased the diameter, then you've changed the resistance, right? And so the fire hose compared to the garden hose, you get a lot more flow through the fire hose than your garden hose. How much flow? Well, it's this relationship which we should know. The resistance is proportional to 1 over R to the fourth power. So I know that everybody's freaking out. And what's the fourth power? How do I do that if I have that on a test or some standardized exam? Remember, let's say it was 2 times larger, or 1 to 2, right? 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, right? So you can figure that out. And this is the same idea here. So 2 times 2, 4, you know, this whole thing. And so you can see how much larger that would be, 16 times different, if it just increased 2 times that of vessel 1. So the major difference is this resistance. So if we go back to these, we can kind of get the idea that we just talked about. You know, contraction of the heart for the pressure, and then this pressure gradient changes too, just like when we stand up. Anybody ever get out of bed really quick, right, and you kind of a little dizzy? Right, take that first step, and you're kind of like, whoa, right? No one ever has those problems. You get it every morning, just stress of getting up. But if you stop, just stop for a second, then what happens? So what's the whole system here? This is what we should be thinking about. What happens? Just step out of bed really quickly. You think you're late to a test. And then what happens? Stand up. Blood pressure drops, right? What's going to detect the blood pressure? What detects his blood pressure? Think of what we talked about. Sinus headache, which is related to carotid sinuses, right? So carotid sinuses. We're going to get a cattle prog. Okay, carotid sinuses, right? So they detect, the carotid sinuses detect that pressure, right? And then it signals to the brain, says, oh, pressure's too low, does it drop? Activates sympathetic nervous system. Your heart rate goes up just a little bit too, but you get vasoconstriction in your arterioles and your veins. What's that going to do to blood pressure? Pushes it back up. Oh, now I got blood flow back to my brain. I can see again. I'm not having that blackout. And then you continue to run on to your late class, right? So that's kind of neat. But a lot of examples have been done with this giraffe because of those long necks that they have. And think about them bending down to drink water. The pressure difference in their head, right? And how they have to control that. That's pretty amazing to think about. All right. So this equation isn't so bad if we just think about it in general. Resistance. And I know 8 NL
over pi, right, that's pi, to the fourth power. So the main point to remember here is related to the 1 over r to the fourth power. It's proportional to this radius, inversely proportional to the radius of the fourth power. The other main point to think about is this n here, viscosity, and how to relate to that. If you have a bigger blood vessel, less resistance, right? So that's the inverse. But if you have an increase in viscosity, like that Lance Armstrong injecting erythropoietin, right, and increasing the red blood cells, what's that going to do to resistance? Increases resistance directly, right? So it's directly proportional. So the main things to think of is direct proportional versus inversely proportional. So if you increase the viscosity of the fluid, then that's going to increase resistance. Okay, so radius of the vessel, very important. Fourth power, inverse. All right, so that's just another example that we just went through. Okay, so we should think about flow of blood flow and excretion. Where does this blood go to in the fluids? What's the whole purpose, like we talked about in the beginning of this chapter? Get nutrients, get fluid to the cells, right? Take away waste products. So we got to get this out there. But what's related with all this blood pressure is a lot of animals use this for locomotion, like spiders, arachnoids or spiders, you know, for their legs to extend out. Some animals use this to eject processes, to like dig in the sand. It's pretty neat. This pressure is very important for your kidneys, for making urine. I don't know if you remember in the urine lab, did they tell you about a minimal pressure for making urine for your kidneys to function? If your blood pressure drops too low, you can't actually push blood through your kidneys, and your kidneys will fail because the capillary beds are so small in there. And you can have acute renal failure when your pressure drops too low. And then what happens if the tissue is not getting oxygenation? And you know that the glomeruli, right, and all that energy demanding processes are really high, right? So it needs a lot of oxygen. But if the pressure drops too low, it can't get blood. And then the oxygen can't get in there, right? And then the tissue dies. And then you go into from acute renal failure to permanent renal failure. And so it's really important to keep the blood pressure up. If it goes too low, your kidneys are going to start to die out. And then, you know, for sexual reproduction parts. But also some animals use this to eject other parts, like this little nose thing when it's digging around or is needing to smell, or bivalves pressures. Okay, kind of cool. And we've already talked about some neat aspects with control of heart rate and myogenic versus neurogenic. Remember, myogenic, like us, our hearts beat without the nervous system. Other animals, many invertebrates, are neurogenic. They can't beat without the heart. But some aspects are myogenic. It depends on the animal. Just, you don't have to memorize the differences. But remember in the CNN news, or someone emailed me about that, the new organ, right? The interstitium. So it's pretty neat, too, to think about. The fluids that people are finding. Last year, it happened to do with the mesentery around the GI tract, and everything was a new organ. Now this year, it's this, the compartments of fluids. But some animals have multiple extracellular compartments where they don't mix, actually, so it's kind of interesting, but it's just kind of extra stuff. Okay, and we've already talked about crustacean insects pretty much, and remember that insects really don't use the blood for circulating gases, right, because they have a tracheal system. We'll talk about respiratory later on, but trachea go right down to the tissues. Pretty neat, though, they can actually fill up the blood vessels with the latex dye, a latex that then hardens up, and then you use nitric acid, and it dissolves the cuticle and muscle and everything around it, and you're left with the outline of the circulatory system. So you can actually see that it's very robust. In an open circulatory animal, right? Or open circulatory system, and we think, oh, it's just the heart pumping out blood and that's it. But look, it has a very fine capillary beds over the gills, and it actually has these branches that go down into the muscle. This would be the claws, and branches of the blood vessels down into the muscle, but then these are open-ending here, and it just goes out to the leg, and then because of the cuticles all around it, the blood just comes back into the body chamber and then goes back into the heart. But the gills actually have a kind of closed system through the gills because it's going through a capillary bed and then back to the heart and then out to the different tissues. And remember, these animals can regulate blood flow in their arterial system because they can close off different regions and actually regulate blood flow to their muscles or their GI tract. So these animals can control blood flow to different tissues. Somebody emailed that on the weekend from an old exam question that we had, so that was kind of neat to think about. Okay, and we won't spend all the time on crayfish. But the other points to remember is that fishes have two chambered hearts. They have an atrium and a ventricle. Amphibians have a three chambered heart, kind of standardized questions, two atrium and a ventricle. But it's really quite neat because this ventricle can kind of move back and forth depending on how to get the blood flow. I don't want you to have to memorize all the little details here, but if you look at two atrium and kind of this ventricle, you see this open ventricle, and it can actually mix blood, but it's beginning to kind of get two different components here, it's kind of an early mammalian heart, but it's neat that the blood can mix in this kind of ventricular chamber, and then you see in the more advanced mammals that this will then close off. So the main points are we'll talk about it in the respiratory system when we get there. Amphibians can get a lot of oxygenation, not through lungs, right, but through what? Skin. And so they have a good perfusion to their skin to get oxygenation across. But then other animals like the fish, the gills, but you see this throughout the animal world. First, the heart goes to the respiratory structure, and then out to the systemic circulation. So it doesn't matter if it's really the crayfish, because you saw blood vessels straight from the heart to the gills first, and then that came back to the heart, and then out to the systemic. The fish, the same way, ventricles to the gills, and then out to the body. And we're going to see the same kind of idea with us, right? It goes through our lungs first, and then out to the systemic circulation. Isn't that pretty cool? So it all follows pretty neat stuff. There are some really neat examples of African lungfish, and they're called lungfish. And there's some textbooks talk about the Australian lungfish and African lungfish. They're different, but I don't want to test you over the differences of things like that. It's not, you know, that nitty-gritty little thing. But the idea is that these fish, and there's a lot of folklore about it, because in Africa, in the ponds, when they would dry up, what would the farmers do? They want to use that soil and plant their crops for the summer, right? Or whenever time. So they would dig the ground and plant something, and all of a sudden these fish would come out of the ground. They're like, oh my God, life has been created from the earth. But no, what it is that these fish actually live in the water, and when the water's there, they use their gills, and when the water pond dries up, they actually make a mucus coating around them and kind of burrow down in the mud. And they have this mucus coating around them to keep them moist. But now they can use their lungs to breathe. Is that not cool? So they can actually, they have lungs, and they can breathe through their lungs and get oxygenation. But when the water comes back on, they can use their gills. And there's different arrangements in the Australian lungfish compared to divergent, you know, different evolutionary processes came about, is what they think. But the system's a little bit different between the two, but basically the same idea, gills in a lung, and then circulation going through the two, and they can use them as they need to. So that's pretty cool to think about these animals, and it caused a lot of folklore and probably religious beliefs because of this as well. Reptiles, three-chambered heart. Now here's where standardized exams have come into. Where do you see, like in the animal group, in the process of more advanced animals, the crocodiles are the first time you see the four-chambered heart with two atrium and two ventricles. But they still have something very unusual. They have this foramen of Panizzi, if I pronounce it right. Anybody Italian in here? I always ask that question. But Panizzi, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly. And some textbooks make a little bit more about this. The idea is that this is really quite neat. Crocodiles are diving animals. And when they dive, they don't need to circulate blood through their lungs so much, right? Because they're diving, so they're not getting that lot of oxygen. But they do hold their breath, so they can get some oxygen from the lungs when they hold it, but they don't need as much perfusion. So it's a little confusing sometimes, but the general idea is the right ventricle and the left ventricle in the crocodile, the right ventricle actually has two valves that leave it. One, to the pulmonary artery, but they also have what's called a left aorta. And that left aorta has a branch over to the left ventricle, the aorta that we're familiar with, right, mammals, and there's a branch between these two, the left aorta and the normal aorta that comes out of the left ventricle. and blood can go that way to bypass the lungs. So that's what this foramen of Pazizi is. It's just to bypass the lungs when the animal's diving. So it's kind of neat to think about. It's really quite cool. So, but the main point is to remember crocodiles have the four-chambered heart. The first time you see them in the animal, like, evolutionary process. Okay, and then this kind of goes through all that. And there's that little foramen. And, you know, blood can go actually both directions. Some animals have little differences. There's even some subtle differences between types of crocodiles. But I don't want you to have to go through all that stuff. Birds, mammals, we're all four-chambered. So birds are like us. What's really quite neat, too, is in the fetus, it's developing in females, right? Where is the oxygen coming from? Now, this has been in standardized exams, and it has been some of our older exams because we spent some time on this. Now, which side? So what's the most oxygenated vessel in your body, veins or arteries? What are you supposed to tell me? Veins or arteries? If somebody just asks you that, oh, arteries are always the most oxygenated, what are you going to say? Sorry, Charlie, got it wrong. Didn't take animal to this. Right? What are you going to say? Vein. Right? Which vein? Pulmonary vein, right? And which artery is probably the most least oxygenated? Not unoxygenated, but least oxygenated. Which artery? Arteries lead the heart. Pulmonary artery, right? Because it's going to the lungs. It just finished going through the whole systemic circulation. Just got lymph that went into the right side too, so you're just mixing in with all the lymph that's not highly oxygenated. And then that's all mixing in. That's going to the right side. And now you're going to get oxygenation, but it's leaving the heart. So it's an artery, right? So the pulmonary artery, least oxygenated, if you will. But fetus. Now, when you think about the fetal circulation, what side's going to have the most oxygenation? Or where is the highest oxygenation coming in? On the right side. So it's a little bit backwards thinking, all right? Because if we go to this, I'll show you in a second, the diagram, you'll get to that point. And then, you know, systemic circulation, as we just talked about. Some other points here just to remember while we're on this. Elastic recoil, aorta, capillary bed. Capillary bed, veins storing blood, right? And then you can mobilize your blood volume into your full circulation just by contracting all these veins. Okay, this diagram is too much to look through, but the main point, I just put that in there, so if you're looking over this for your own purposes, it's kind of neat to have it all context. The main point is, right here, I'll just show you this figure. When you're developing as a fetus, you actually have six gill arches. They call them six gill arches. And embryology is a great course if we would offer it more. So your heart, when you're developed, you have these six gill arches. It's pretty cool. But as you develop as a fetus, these little gill arches, and it's just no different than really a fish, when these gill arches close off as you go through fetal development, and they become ligaments in you. And you can still see them in you as an adult, these little ligaments that go across. Now, what happens with these gill arches? If different ones close off, some of them become the coronary artery. I mean, become the carotid arteries. Other ones become your aorta. Now, what's really kind of neat, when you see, look at the ligaments right here. These are ligaments left over. And this is becoming, which one is this? This is the aorta right there? Yes, I think so. This is the aorta and the descending. But why come off this side and not the other side? So when you develop it this way, why don't you develop the other way? And that can happen. People, generally, you have your aorta coming off going this direction on your left side. But some people have an aorta coming off the right side, and they're doing just fine. But it's really weird, and, you know, that can happen. So you can have an aorta coming off your right side. It's kind of flipped. Isn't that kind of cool? But it's not coming from your right ventricle. It's coming from your left ventricles. You know, but it just developed coming off on your right side instead of your left side. It's rare, but it happens. So it's kind of neat. But it all comes in the embryological development. But when you're a fetus, do you need to be perfusing your lungs that's developing? Are you getting oxygen from your lungs? No. And your lungs aren't developing yet, right? Your lungs are really kind of later to develop because they don't need to right away when you're a fetus. What's really early on is your heart. So that's why they listen for the heartbeat, right? And so the heart's developing, and you don't have a lot of blood flow needing to go to the lungs, but you got to get something there. The lungs are developing. So what do? You're like that diving crocodile. You need to bypass it. So how do you bypass it? Well, in your atria, there's actually a hole between your right atria and your left atria. So blood will go from your right atria over into your left atria. Isn't that cool? There's a hole there. You ever hear of a blue baby? A blue baby that's born? They're called blue babies not because they're royalty, but they're, you know, blue bloods are supposed to be like royalty, right? But they actually are blue because they're not getting oxygen. And so they're not getting oxygen usually because of two things. One, the septum between the two atria didn't close before fetal development. So what the cardiologist can do is to go in with a little catheter, and they can actually sometimes just push the flap to make the tissue touch, and as soon as it touches, it seals up. That's pretty cool. The other problem is the ductus arteriosus. Now, just like, kind of like the crocodile, the pulmonary artery and the aorta, there's a vessel between the two. But after you're born, that one closes. And it's, you know, needs to close, right? If it doesn't close, what happens? You don't get good oxygenation through your lungs. So that's kind of important. And so this ductus arteriosus is this sixth gill arch right here. And if we go back, go back one. Let's see. I think it says sixth gill arch. Where does it say ductus arteriosus? Somewhere here. Somewhere in here is the ductus arteriosus on the sixth gill arch. So it's the sixth gill arch that makes that ductus arteriosus, and it closes when you get higher oxygenation. Now, what's kind of interesting is that people at high altitudes, like in Chile, you know, Machu Picchu, up in there. If you ever get a chance to go there, it'd be cool. I've never gone there yet. I want to. Bucket list. The people that live up at high altitudes, what the government does is actually have the people come down to lower altitude to have babies. The reason is when they're born at high altitude, they keep a patent ductus arteriosus, and it's a problem. So they actually have them come down to lower altitude to have their babies, and then after they have their baby, they can go back up to higher altitude. They live up there. They're indigenous to the higher altitudes. So that's kind of neat to think about. Now, there's some other things that are really interesting, too. The ductus arteriosus is sensitive to drugs. It's sensitive to indomethacin. What's indomethacin? Like your anti-inflammatory drug, right? If you take that, you can actually alter your. If a mother takes it while the fetus is developing, it can actually change how the ductus arteriosus actually responds to oxygenation the first time. So it's kind of interesting. You don't want to be on these meds when someone's fetus, when you're developing. So there's lots of things to think about with this. But if we look at now the fetal circulation, you don't have to memorize this part, the ductus venous, but you're getting blood from your placenta, oxygenated blood is going through there. Remember, the blood's not exchanging with the mother, but you're getting oxygenation from the capillary beds and the placenta. It's going through, coming into the right side, and then here is we can see the foramen ovale. That's the valve, that's the patch between the two atria. And then you see the ductus arteriosus between the pulmonary artery and the aorta. And so blood can bypass going through the lungs. And then as your fetus develops, this foramen ovale closes. And then, usually right at birth, hopefully, the ductus arteriosus closes. And if that doesn't close, that can go in and either give some compounds. It's really like through a prostaglandin E2. So prostaglandins, people take anti-inflammatories to keep prostaglandins down, right? So prostaglandins close this so they can give an injection and basically help to close the ductus arteriosus. But if you ever hear of a blue baby, it might be either the foramen ovale or the ductus arteriosus. Okay, I don't want to go through these sounds, but there's a lot of websites that if you're interested sometime on your own over the summer and you're bored, go to the webpage and just listen to sounds. There's all these different abnormalities with hearts and things like that.
Did you? Yeah. Did they pushed it closed, or did they do
no,
a surgery?
It just closed on its own.
It closed on its own? Yeah.
Then that can happen, right?
Yeah, so.
And some people are, you know, it works just fine. There's lots of abnormalities that can happen, and then they're fine things later on. That's what's kind of cool. So this is where I was telling you about indomethacin. Ductus constriction can also occur in utero with maternal indomethacin administration. So what happens when the mother feels like, oh, I feel like I'm getting sick and I need to take a pill, I need to take my anti-inflammatory, I have, you know, gout, or I don't feel well, and then they're closing this. What might be the difference for the fetal development? You know, these are the kind of problems. And so, kind of interesting to think about. Best to stay away from any kind of meds. But so, and here's this surgical ligation that's needed. Usually if the mother's been taking it, they need to then go in and actually surgically ligate it, because now the tissue's not sensitive to the medications that they give. So it's kind of interesting. All right, so I don't want you to have to memorize these kind of equations, but just to kind of think about it, they can actually tell the development of your normal embryonic heart by the heart rate. And it's really quite neat. So the embryonic heart, if you listen to a mother, they want to know if they're pregnant or not. You listen to the mother, you hear two heartbeats. Oh, there's something going on. And how can you hear two heartbeats? Usually because the fetal heart's beating a lot faster than the mother's heart. And so that's kind of neat. And look at this little thing. It's just going away. Look at that. Wow. 185 beats per minute. That thing's a monster, right? Just, you know, ticking along there. Versus you, it's 70 beats per minute, right? It's amazing. And they can actually figure out the age of the fetus by this general equation. So it's pretty neat, and it changes throughout the fetal development. So here's the general, and you see all the data points, but in general, right, boom, and throughout there. So it's kind of neat to think about, and what's regulating the heart, and how does this develop, right? So pretty neat to think about. Lots of heart diseases in infants and development. If you're ever interested in cardiology, wow, I think that's such a cool field to be into. There are so many developmental problems. I don't want you to memorize these, but you can see that a lot of these different things come about, and other problems, like here's one, hypercalcemia, hypoplastic nails, where your nails don't develop right. So you can imagine some developmental abnormality, but then these things all go together. So one developmental abnormality usually relates to some other ones as well. Coloboma, you probably know some people in our department. There's two, Ann Morris as well as Jacob Famoski. They're working with coloboma, where the iris doesn't develop right. But there's other defects that happen in the individual too, such as the heart's not developing right. So lots of things that are kind of interesting with this. And if you look at some of these common cardiac malformations, and my wife's the unit coordinator at Central Baptist Hospital. She's a nurse, graduated from UK here 20-something years ago. And so she's the unit coordinator up there now at the mother and baby unit at Central Baptist, and she sees lots of these kind of interesting aspects. They either fly them here to get them over here to UK. Sometimes UK can't deal with these, and they actually go over to Cincinnati Children's Hospital and get surgeries done there that we can't do here, or they'll actually even go to Nashville or Cozar in Louisville sometimes. So it's kind of interesting, these things. And some of these problems they can correct, and some of them they can't. But lots of interesting aspects. If you think about some of the main ones, here's this one, tract defects. The stratology of Fallot is four different things that go wrong with the heart in heart development. So that's kind of neat. Well, not for the people that get it. But pulmonary stenosis, the valves not working well on the pulmonary side. Septal defects, like the ventricle doesn't close, right? So that's pretty interesting too. And then you think about, I don't want you to have to memorize these different things, but if you're interested, these four different things are really standard with these different disorders. And the septum doesn't develop, the aorta is too small, can't get blood flow through, it doesn't develop right. But with surgery, they can collect a lot of these issues, but some of these they really can't correct very well. So 10% mortality on these. Hypoplasic, you might have heard of somebody with the left heart that doesn't develop. You can imagine if your left heart doesn't develop, that's to pump blood out to your systemic circulation, and you know, mortality might be higher. They still look for heart transplants, but these kids are kind of small, right? Little infants. What animal do they usually transplant with some of the infant hearts? Anybody have an idea? They used to do more of it, but now it's becoming more and more problematic. And they even do it with human hearts.
Another animal? Baboons. And so the baboon heart's about the size of our heart, a little bit smaller, but sometimes they can do this, or put them on machines.
So, and we know that pig valves are used commonly, right, to actually use for your valves. U of L was actually well recognized for developing artificial heart valves. The problem with these mechanical valves is they were damaging the red blood cells, and they would end up damaging them, and they would have the lysis. So actually the natural valves, like from pig valves, were really quite interesting because they would work better. There's some really interesting cultural issues with this too, with people not wanting to use pigs for one reason or another, but they actually save people's lives. So kind of interesting to think about.
Okay, arrhythmias are really common. But you think about all these channels that, you know, work in the heart, and you could have an arrhythmia from so many different aspects, right? It just kind of make us aware that there's a lot of different things. As you develop from a fetus to adult, all these different channels, these are currents for calcium, sodium, potassium, different types of channels, they all change in their distribution or in their expression levels, and that changes how your heart works. So just imagine if you have an ion channel pathology. Like we said, 1/3 to almost 50% of all pregnancies end up in spontaneous abortions. A lot of times they think it has to do with ion channel pathologies. And you can imagine if your heart doesn't develop right as a fetus, the rest of the body's not going to develop right, and then it spontaneously aborts. But they try to figure out why. Is it a genetic link, or is it just a random mutation that might have happened? Okay, so kind of interesting. In SIDS, we talked a little bit about, they think that some of the SIDS might be channel pathologies. There's lots of different reasons that people are now relating to SIDS, and they're actually dividing SIDS up into different categories for reasons that a sudden infant death syndrome might occur. Kind of neat. If you're not going to med school, maybe, and you're not interested in the big deaths and things, there's so many other professions that you can get into that are really cool. I saw this echocardiologist before doing echocardiograms on children, and they are so neat because they then take these readings and then send it to the cardiologist, you know, through the internet, and they can read it at home or wherever they are and figure out the problems. But if they don't do it right and they don't get the right readings, then it doesn't do any good. So they're just as important as anybody else in detecting these kind of problems. Pretty neat. So if you're looking for jobs, there are jobs that people just read EKG traces all day long, right? And they actually look at those and print them out and give them, you know, for their files, or maybe now digitally. There are these people that go around and do these echocardiograms. It's so amazing. They can get their ventricular volume. They can get ejection fraction. They can get the arrangement of the heart. They can see septal defects. They can do so many things with echocardiograms. Pretty cool to think about. So let's just kind of whip through some of this
other aspects, and then we'll take a break
and then think about. So circulation in vessels. Remember, we already talked about the Winkessel effect. Right, the aorta extending. What does this do? The distensibility. It maintains the pressure wave, right? So that distensibility is very important for maintaining your pressure. What if you had, let's take two examples. And we used to build these for high schools and middle schools. What if you had a pump here? You're pumping blood into this vessel, and you had a balloon here. This balloon extends. And then you had a tube, all right, with a little resistance down here. Well, if that balloon fills up and this pump is pumping, fills up, and then the pressure comes down, you know, there's a valve here, it can't go back with the pump. And then you maintain that pressure. But what if it's a steel pipe? What if you don't have that distensibility? What's going to happen to the pressure wave inside of this aorta? What's going to happen? So if you have a pump and this balloon extends, does the pressure, is that, what's the peak pressure going to be compared to if that's a steel pipe? Let's think about that. So distensibility is going to do what? Take the pressure wave away, right? So your peak pressure won't be as high. The systole will not be as high pressure. Now, if it's a steel pipe and you pump the same amount of blood in there, what's going to happen? Right? Skyrocket high, right? And then it doesn't have the distensibility, it doesn't have the elastic recoil, so what happens to the pressure wave? Super high, and then as it goes down, it's going to drop really low. So what's going to happen to what's called pulse pressure? Pulse pressure goes high and then low. What's going to happen if you have distensibility? Well, it's not going to go as high, but what happens to the bottom? As this elastic recoil comes back down, it can maintain. So it goes up, and then it comes down, but not up and down, right? So pulse pressure would be larger or a greater difference in somebody with atherosclerosis, plaque buildup in their aorta, because they don't have the distensibility. Or hardening of the arteries you've heard of, right? So that's like a sealed pipe. But you have a nice normal heart circulatory system, then you can have that distensibility and your pulse pressure is not so crazy. So think about that pulse pressure in your coronary artery, or that pulse pressure that's going to your brain, right? So somebody with a steel pipe, that pulse pressure is also shooting up into the brain, carotid artery, and now you're going to blow some blood vessels, right? So this is why hypertension is really bad, but also atherosclerosis is really bad, or hardening of the arteries. Okay, I get off my soapbox. Okay, all right, there we go. So mean arterial pressure, really important to remember systole and diastole, and mean arterial pressure is a way to measure your average blood pressure and your artery. And people use this equation. People use this equation on old exams and in clinics. In general, it holds true. There's some debate about it, but in general, diastolic pressure plus one-third systolic minus diastolic gives you your mean arterial pressure. Okay. And what are we talking about? This pulse pressure that we talked about, the peaks, stenosis, I mean, hardening of the arteries, the mean pressure is this average through there, but it's not just systole averaging with diastole or halfway in between point. It's this equation, diastolic pressure plus one-third systolic minus diastolic. Okay. So we've talked about that. Okay. And arterioles are where you have the greatest drop. I think if we just show this picture, it has a little bit of everything. So you see the pulse pressure right here, left ventricle. Well, boom, and then relax, right? Pushes that blood into the aorta. Here's your nice distensible aorta, and it maintains that pressure. If it was a steel pipe, you would probably see this drop a lot lower and maybe even peak up a bit higher. And then where do we see the greatest drop in mean pressure? The greatest drop occurs not in the capillary beds, which people will put on an exam. It's in the arterioles, because why? This is where you have your smooth muscle that's wrapped around the blood vessels, right? This is where you have the best control of this, dropping that from the large artery down to the smaller arterioles. So the largest drop in the pressure occurs in the systemic circulation occurs in the arterioles. Okay? But the greatest surface area in your circulatory system, total surface area, is where? Capillary beds. The biggest blood vessels, like your aorta, right? But the biggest surface area total is your capillary beds. So you can see those, you can see that. It's kind of cool. All right. We already talked about intrinsic controls before. Metabolic activity, temperature causes vasodilation. CO2, or drop in pH, causes vasodilation. It's pretty neat to think about, as we talked about with temperature. All right. And, you know, the same ideas, general ideas. They're just on the PowerPoints for you to kind of get the idea of these. We've already talked about sympathetic and parasympathetic, but it is kind of interesting. It depends which blood vessels the sympathetic system works on. So in your lungs and brain, you don't really have sympathetic innervation to those arteries, arterioles, because why? You don't want to be constricting your arterial bed to your coronary artery, and you don't want to be constricting it to your lungs, so you don't really need the sympathetic innervation to cause constriction. Those are the alpha receptors. But you might have dilation, so you might have beta receptors, right? Beta receptors can actually enhance dilation to the heart. So those are kind of neat because they cause vasodilation. And these are what you might hear of people taking an agonist that actually can help the heart to open up and dilate. All right, so kind of neat to think about the general ideas. So these diagrams are pretty good to kind of go through just to get you the idea of what's intrinsic, what's extrinsic. Extrinsic goes back to your hormones like vasopressin, angiotensin, epinephrine. Intrinsic, like we just talked about, temperature, low pH, right? Adenosine being released to control resistance in blood flow. All right.
And let's just go through this real fast. Capillary beds are so cool. Here's your little red blood cell with a disc. They stream on right on through. And why do we have this, you know, blood vessel, the red blood cell in there? Well, we talked about that before, because you have your, you know, your carbonic anhydrase, hemoglobin all there, so you can transport oxygen well. Now, if we look inside these capillaries and the different tissues, you have different types of pores, if you will, or leakage out of the capillary bed. You need to get nutrients out and the waste products in right from the tissue. So different types of pores, if you will, into your capillary bed. So they have different types. This is a continuous capillary. This would be like in your skeletal muscle, right? Small water-soluble substances like glucose, sodium, potassium can go on through, right? And you can see they kind of get right on through. And then you think about other ones that might be need to be transported, or bigger ones like maybe in your pores that could be for filtration, like in your kidneys. And so larger molecules would be for blood vessels like to your kidneys. We'll talk about those. We've talked about waste products and that kind of stuff before, getting out glucose in. So you want to get that to the tissues in the capillary beds, but you want to get waste products out of those, so primarily CO2 and maybe extra waste products. And then regulation, we've talked about arterioles, or where you have the biggest drop in blood pressure, right? Because, and you can control which where blood flow goes by constricting these. So kind of the general ideas, just like, you know, in a cold day, you know, your hands constrict, right? Your hands feel really cold because the arterioles are constricting there to keep blood from going out there, so you don't bring back cold blood into your body cavity. Pretty neat. So here's a good diagram to think about surface area. Surface area is the greatest in the capillary beds, and you think about velocity of blood flow really drops. Low points here in the capillaries too. What is it? Yeah, velocity. And what's this one? Total cross-section area and blood flow rate. You know, it's going to stay the same, right? About 5 liters per minute through the total tissues. Where is blood pressure the lowest in the systemic circulation? Question on old exam. Somebody emailed this weekend about that. Where is blood pressure the lowest? Closed circulatory system in a mammal. But not talking about the heart, just systemic circulation. Let's say A, aorta. B, arterioles. C, capillary beds. D, venules. E, vena cava. That's right before it comes into the heart. What do you think? Can pressure go from low to high? Blood flow from low to high. It always goes from high to low, right? So the lowest is before the pump. Right. If it was so low in the capillary bed, how is it going to, you know, get into the veins to get back to your heart? So the lowest point in the systemic is in the vena cava before it gets back into your heart, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be able to go around the system. People get that confused on standardized exams. All right. So let's just go through a little bit of this, and then we'll take a break. In your capillary bed, the major points, think about the arterial side versus the venous side. What drives the fluid to go out of the capillary bed on the arterial side? It's the pressure, the hydrostatic pressure. Now, this figure in some textbooks show this, and it's a little confusing. So, in general, though, this little pie-shaped thing is anionic pressure. What is that related to? The osmotic gradient, all right? The proteins, the salts, things like this. So what if